Huge public controversy has surrounded the issue of religious-based courts for arbitrating disputes in family matters, divorce, custody, property division. More precisely, the public controversy has been intense when this mechanism concerned one particular religion, Islam. The dispute was country-wide, though the process under consideration was provincial, specific to Ontario. Then, without forewarning, but clearly in response to the intensity of the controversy, Premier Dalton McGuinty of Ontario declared his intention to end religious-based courts of arbitration for every group. To discuss the character of the controversy that has raged around the use by Muslims, specifically of religious-based arbitration courts, I'm joined in the studio by Itras Syed. She's a graduate student in the UBC Women's Study Program and has been researching this topic. Good morning, Itras, and welcome to Red Eye.
Thank you. Good morning to you, too.
To start, what did the original Ontario legislation do?
Well, my understanding, and I'm not a lawyer, it's in 1991 there was passed an Arbitration Act which allowed various faith communities to access that act and to apply for standing, groups within various communities to apply for standing to provide arbitration services to their communities. And my understanding is that the Ismaili community, the Jewish community, and certain denominations within the Christian community have applied and are conducting arbitration for the last however many years.
And so they were all approved for it?
Yes.
Originally. Was there any public controversy when these groups first were approved?
No. I mean, it's a little bit before my political lifetime, but mm-hmm. No, I don't recall of any, and nor can I find any evidence of any in my research.
And so it was only when a group of Sunni Muslims applied that it did become controversial.
Right. So in this particular case is that there is an organization called the Institute for Islamic Civil Justice, I believe is their name. They've applied for standing under the Act to provide the arbitration services. And again, they are one group of, I think, a very small number of people within the larger Muslim community. And just to emphasize that, the Ismaili Muslim community is also part of the larger Muslim community, and they've applied for it and have been conducting it without any controversy surrounding it.
Okay. How would you characterize the arguments made against granting Sunni Muslims the right to use arbitration as other religions were?
Well, that's been the bulk of my research. I have obviously some understanding of the proposal itself, and I have opinions about it, but my research has really been about looking at the discourse that surrounded it in Canada in this past year and a bit. And from what I can see, the opposition has structured itself around three key points. The first being the infantilization of women, of Muslim women, and the idea that Muslim women as a group are uneducated, unempowered, ill-informed of their rights, and inarticulate, and as such require that the entire nation intervene and protect Muslim women because as a group we are apparently unable to protect ourselves. And within that, I mean, obviously that's a racialization of Muslim women, and that's how Muslim women have been racialized in Canada. But with that is the other side of that coin is the racialization of Muslim men. That Muslim men are hypersexualized, hypersexist, and that the sexism experienced by Muslim women in our communities is of a substantive nature that is completely distinct and unlike the sexism experienced by any other women in any other community in Canada.
And so it wasn't seen with women of other religions that they were needed to be protected from
No.
from men within their religion.
Because we don't racialize Jewish women or Christian women as needing support or needing protection from their own people. We our understanding of them is not that they are inarticulate and unable to protect themselves and don't know what's good for them. Whereas Muslim women are definitely the way I look at some of the articles and the op-ed pieces and the media statements and sort of what my understanding is that the way the term Muslim woman has been constructed as a static category that denotes complete and absolute oppression, unvaryingly so. And not only does that say something about the assumption of the homogeneity of the entire Muslim community, but of the racialization process of what we perceive Muslim women to be in Canada.
How did you conduct your research?
I've just been looking, been collecting all the articles that have been published. I've been collecting all the media statements that have been put out by various organizations. So as I was saying, that's the first mm-hmm. issue, I think, at hand. And the second pillar of that opposition is the idea that the Muslim community, the demonization of the entire Muslim community. So the idea, so the way that it's being constructed is that this is not an issue of Canadian Muslims accessing provisions in provincial legislation, but it's being constructed as if Canadian Muslims are the fifth column in a larger clash of civilizations, and the real intent of which is to destroy all things good in Canada. And as a result, the entire nation must rise and defend against this because it is a is an assault of that proportion. And so it's a process of delegitimizing the rights of Canadian Muslims to engage in discourse around Canadian law. And to say that that's not what's happening at all, but rather that this is just a smokescreen for a larger assault. And you could see in the media statements and lots of the op-ed pieces, organizations like, say, the Muslim Canadian Congress often refer to things that this, you know, right after the Marion Boyd commission was put forth, they often refer to things as that being a gift to the mullahs of Iran and to the Taliban. And so making delegitimizing the right of Canadian Muslims to interrogate and to engage in any kind of national discourse. As such, we're immediately denationalized by those kinds of links.
And you found that that doesn't happen to the other religious groups?
No. I mean, have you ever heard of anything like that?
No.
Right. And my argument is that the third pillar is the idea of the fossilization of Islamic law, that the Islamic law is no longer a human process that is constantly being reinterpreted, constantly being re-engaged, and all of that process of which there is a huge discourse of contemporary engagement with the law, much of it by Muslim feminists, simply doesn't exist in the structure of this debate. There seems to be some kind of universal agreement among the opposition that Islamic law is dead. So there can be no contemporary reinterpretation. There can be no feminist reading of it, just as there are feminist readings of all religions and all faith discourses. But there can't be in Islam because it's not possible. It's dead. It's over. And as such, it sort of characterizes not only that Islamic law is dead, but that Muslims as a community and as a larger global community are not alive. We're not engaged in any kind of process of interrogating our faith or reinterpreting it, or in any way doing what all other people of faith do in the world, which is constantly re-examine and trying to make it relevant in our contemporary surroundings. So it's a way of not only saying that Islamic law is fossilized, but Muslims also are apparently all dead.
Where do you think this perception comes from?
Well, I mean, that's a larger question, but my argument obviously is not that these kinds of because these are all very classic colonial tropes, you know, and what I argue is that this somewhat forms the idea of the new white man's burden, this one being about saving brown women from brown men. None of this is new. I mean, it's existed in our political fabric. It's existed in our in the way that we racialize women of color. It's always been there. It's part of the colonial history. However, my argument is that those in opposition to it have chosen to invoke all of these colonial tropes.
How would you characterize the response to McGuinty's decision to eliminate all faith-based arbitration?
How would I characterize his decision?
Yeah, sort of the general response to that decision, and then as well the response by the other religious groups that were benefiting from this arbitration.
Well, for me, it seems a lot like that which has happened in France in the recent move to ban Muslim girls from wearing headscarves in French schools. Part of that was that Sikh boys who wear turbans and who'd been wearing turbans in French schools for forever, it seems, you know, since the Sikh community had been in France, were also disallowed from doing so. So it's sort of a cover to get away from admitting this is not anything to do with the Jewish or the Ismaili or the Christian communities, but to do with the larger Muslim community.
And what about the religious groups that were using faith-based arbitration? How have they reacted now that they don't have a privilege? Are they trying to distance themselves or to well, to create a partnership?
I'm not sure. I mean, I've heard both things, mm-hmm. And I'm waiting to see how that, like whether they do put forth a challenge to this ruling and how they structure it. I think that'll be an interesting thing to see as it unfolds.
What's your own take on faith-based courts?
Well, I was opposed to the arbitration proposal from the beginning because I have a lot of reservations about the way that the proposal was written and a lot of what I see are gaping holes in the way that it's presented and being discussed. The beginning, to start with, the concept of binding arbitration, I think, is very problematic when the parameters of what the arbiters are going to be using is left so unclear. So I think women would be going into the situation and not really being assured of or having a realistic idea of what they can expect out of it. So that would be a major reason that I didn't support the proposal. As well, there's lots of terminology that's left unclear. For example, there's a repeated reference to something called Muslim principles, which I would like to see defined because being an active Muslim myself for the whole of my life, I don't actually really know how that would be defined in a universal way. So there are a lot of those kinds of issues, as well as the entire idea of not of women being of not being really clear about the diversity of Islamic interpretation of Islamic law, and there's a wide range of it. So given that, who would be defining the parameters of this arbitration, and what would be, and I've been assured many times but that it would be subject to the charter. What I think would be really important to know is how that would take place. And would the charter be part of the training of the arbiters? And if so, who would be doing that training? What would be the qualifications of the arbiters? And who would this one group be allowed to do this? Or would other groups also within the Muslim community be able to apply to be arbiters? That could represent a much wider range of interpretive opinion in the Muslim community. There's like a lot of questions of the logistics of it. But my argument is that these practical questions, these really, really important questions that make the proposal difficult to support, we were not able to really engage in these kinds of discussions during this past year or so because of the hyperbolic, racist nature of the discourse that surrounded it.
And did you see with the other religions that were using it, was it the same sort of vague definitions?
Well, that's an interesting point. We don't really know because we haven't had any public discussion about that because we as a nation are not concerned about it. And that's the important thing to know about that is that I haven't read detailed accounts of how the Jewish community uses the Arbitration Act. I haven't read detailed accounts of how the Ismaili community uses the act. But it would be important to know and to do a comparative analysis and all of the arguments of one law for all people or the arguments of, you know, we can't have, this is a secular country, we cannot have, religious law. These have never been applied to other faith communities. And you can't divorce the argument from the context within which it has emerged, which is entirely about the Muslim community.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
You're very welcome.
I've been speaking with Idras Syed. She's a graduate student in the UBC's Women's Studies program and is researching the nature of the public debate on Muslim access to the religious-based arbitration courts.